run through our veins, moving monuments to better days. That mountain stands over our darkened.
In Berkeley, I'm Amanda Bellerby. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Just over a month ago, in late December, two beautiful waterways, the Clinch and the Emory Rivers, both adjacent to the Tennessee Valley Authority's massive Kingston coal plant, were poisoned when an earthen dam next to the plant burst, unleashing a toxic slurry of coal ash. More than a billion gallons buried 400 acres of land up to 9 feet deep in thick black muck oozing with arsenic, cadmium, lead, chromium, and mercury, all known to cause cancer and birth defects. It was the largest industrial accident in American history, more than 100 times larger than the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. To add insult to calamity, less than 3 weeks later, on January 9th, another TVA sludge dam burst, sending another 10,000 gallons spewing into Widows Creek, this time in Alabama. The larger Tennessee River is downstream from both of these sites. Ominously, there are no federal regulations classifying coal ash as hazardous waste, and King Coal wants to keep it that way. Joining me by phone to help us understand the scope of these and other coal crimes is Mike Rozell. He was once director of Greenpeace USA and is well known in environmental circles as a brilliant campaigner and strategist. He was also a member of the Youth International Party, or Yippies, and co-founded the Rainforest Action Network, the Ruckus Society, and Earth First. And he's pretty famous for direct actions with a flair for political spectacle, like when he scaled Mount Rushmore and hung a giant gas mask on George Washington's stony face to protest acid rain. Mike has trained 1,000 or 2 people in various forms of nonviolent civil disobedience. He's currently a columnist at lowbagger.org and joins us by phone from the Coal River Valley in West Virginia, where he and others are preparing to take on Massey Energy, also known as King Coal, in the heart of Appalachia. Mike Rozell, welcome back to Flashpoints and Pacifica Radio.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Okay, let's start with the TVA spill in December in Tennessee. You were there soon after that for a couple of weeks, and from what I understand, that part of the Clinch and the Emory River valleys are really devastated. So can you start by just describing the mess and what confronted you when you got there on the ground?
Well, on my first visit, was directly after the spill, and we had heard about it up here in the Coal River Valley in West Virginia. Less than a mile from us is another large impoundment of coal sludge. The folks that are up here that we work with have been monitoring this situation for a long time and have been fearing something exactly like this would happen somewhere, and maybe even here. There was a high security perimeter set up around the spill that we were able to get through, fortunately, with the help of a local person. And it is a really devastating sight. I haven't seen anything like this in my 35-year career. It's a very different kind of a spill than the one that was described in the paper. That was the first thing that I noticed. First of all, it was described as a pond, and it was described as a breach of a dam, and it was described as a spill. And all those things are incorrect. What happened was the collapse of a pile, and this pile was fly ash that came out of the coal-powered generator, which has been burning coal there for 50 years. But this particular kind of ash comes out of the smokestack, and it's the result of, I know you mentioned Mount Rushmore, action that we did a few years ago, many years ago actually, more than I'd like to say. That was to get the sulfur dioxide out of these emissions. And the equipment that was installed was pretty effective. It got about 90%, which is not enough to consider the emissions safe. But the stuff that does come out comes out in this ash. Instead of dumping a lot of these pollutants into the air, we're now collecting them and storing them near a river. The original configuration was a large field, you know, with a small dike in front of it. But over the years, they kept putting layer upon layer of additional ash on it, and it resembled a stepped pyramid. The material that was used for the dike was the same material that was in the pile.
So how high was this pile, Mike?
It was 50 feet high.
Wow. And how high was the so-called dike?
10, 15 feet at the most. And like I said, it wasn't a true dike. I mean, it wasn't made of engineered material. It was just the waste material itself. And it was covered with a very thin layer of clay. And this clay had some grasses, and at the base they'd planted some fast-growing exotic pine trees to kind of make it, you know, blend in with the wildlife refuge that it was directly adjacent to. So, you know, when you talk about a dam, you're usually talking about something that has a certain amount of strength. This was not a dam. It was never meant to contain the collapse of the pile. The pile became somehow supersaturated with water and was unstable. So even if there was a much stronger dam, it may have been blown out, too, by this pile, because we're talking about a lot of material.
Now, the company said that the reason it got so sodden was because of all the rain and the freezing and so on. What is your response to that?
Well, there was rain and freezing, and of course, anybody that lives near one of these dams always gets nervous when this happens, because there's been a history of blowouts during weather events. But this wasn't worse than a normal winter storm. To blame it on the weather is really is inappropriate. This was a failure in the design of the whole system, because they just kept putting stuff on top of stuff on top of stuff. I mean, if you have a compost pile, you know, it takes a lot of rain to soak it all the way to the bottom. One storm couldn't have done that. I suspect that water was getting into the pile through underground means, you know, springs, and something that they weren't aware of. And I would suspect they should be checking the moisture content. They weren't.
Was it lined?
No, it was not lined, and the stuff was put on there wet, and right. That allowed the liquids to drain out through the bottom into the river, but they always claimed that this was inert.
Talk a little bit about what it looked like on the ground. What was it like to walk up to it and look out over it?
Well, I was at one of the residents' house, a fellow named Sandy, and he was right directly across from the dam. The dam had traveled all the way across the slough. Behind the dam was this big avalanche of material from the pile collapsing. So the dam was almost intact.
Pushed forward, you mean?
Yeah, it was pushed forward, and it was in big chunks that people called ashbergs. And then behind it was 20 feet deep in ash. The first couple of days, anyway, the dam was relatively intact, and then after a few more days of rain, it quickly melted away. This kind of demonstrated how flimsy a structure this dam was.
Can you talk about what's actually in this coal ash?
Well, there's all kinds of heavy metals in it. When coal is burned, there are a lot of heavy metals in coal that get concentrated in the ash if they don't go up the stack. All the contaminants that the Clean Air Act mandated them taking out of the air was going into this ash. I think yearly there's 95 million tons of coal ash produced.
Nationally?
Yep.
95 million tons.
Mm-hmm.
Boggles the mind.
That's, you know, the average municipality that burns coal is producing three times more coal ash than they are household and municipal waste. So if you think of a landfill that an average city has, the coal they burn would produce three times that amount of waste. It contains some of the most toxic heavy metals that we know of. And the thing is, this has been called bigger than the Exxon Valdez just because of the sheer amount of these chemicals. And, you know, it's not like they were all dumped in the rotter all at once. This is like a big tea bag, and it will be leaching these chemicals for a long time. The recent tests have shown already that the water quality is exceeding the EPA limits, but once this thing gets really cooking and more water is drained through it, this is something that's going to keep emitting a tremendous amount of heavy metals into the Clinch and Tennessee rivers, which hook up with eventually with the Mississippi and is a source of drinking water for millions and millions of people.
What impacts can you tell us about on water, fish, and animals? Because we haven't heard anything in the major media about any impact on critters other than human beings.
Well, I mean, the first impact was the collapse of the pile, pushed all the water and all the silt on the bottom of the river and everything all the way up to the bank of the other river, which is kind of a hill. All of the wildlife that was in that 400-acre area, it was a riparian forest with, you know, with the river slough and creeks going into it, so all the types of animals you expect to find.
Lots of birds and raccoons and deer.
Yeah, beavers and muskrats and deer and all sorts of reptiles. We saw dead turtles. All that wildlife was obliterated, just completely obliterated. Nothing could have survived, not even a snail. So it was gone. And then there was the other wildlife populations that probably used the area occasionally, and then some of them got back into the area. We've heard stories of very sick and dying animals and that sort of thing. But, I mean, in terms of wildlife habitat, this place has been set back at least 50 years and a lot more. There's nothing there. It's 20 foot deep and hazardous waste, and right now the main thing is that they're trying to get the water to run around it rather than run through it. They're not doing a very good job of that.
What about the drinking water for the local people?
Well, in the beginning, TVA said everybody boil their water, and that didn't make any sense at all, since that's usually for some kind of a bacterial contamination. It doesn't help get rid of heavy metals at all. If anything, it concentrates them. This is an incredible amount of material, and it's going to be releasing over a long period of time. So it's not the big surge like the Exxon Valdez, where a lot of oil was dispersed over a large area immediately. This stuff will be leaching for as long as it's there.
Talk about TVA a little bit. Who are they, and how is it that all this dangerous coal crud is lying around unregulated and kept behind these earthen dikes? How do they get away with this?
Well, I mean, the secret has been that they have not been treating this, even with the kind of environmental regulations that go for household garbage. They refer to this as material. They describe it as inert.
Even though it is the product of meeting the standards of the Clean Air Act.
Right.
nice.
But
nice
they have been able to exempt these kind of ashes from being considered hazardous waste, and that's the only thing that allows these things to be operated in the way that they're operated. I mean, all of these piles are going to fail. It's just a matter of when. And it was much cheaper for them to do it this way. We're going to see a lot more of this unless these things are treated, you know, as hazardous material, which require that it be lined, to be dry, and that nothing be allowed to escape. You know, it's, even so, this is way too much material to ever deal with safely.
How many of these things are there waiting to fail around the country?
There's hundreds of them. 721 power plants. Each one of them are storing waste somewhere, but 156 coal-fired power plants store ash in surface ponds similar to the one that collapsed in Tennessee. They're all near water. They're all susceptible to weather events or failures in engineering, and eventually, they're going to move downriver. They're going to contaminate the water. The only solution to this is to quit making this stuff.
In the first 6 years of the Bush administration, there were proposals for 150 new coal plants, but a bunch of them have been scrapped. So what's your conclusion there? What's happening?
The problem we're having is not with the proposed new coal plants. Not only were over 60 of them canceled last year, it looks like now with the financial crisis that many of the ones that are in the pipeline, they're simply not going to be financing for. And then the uncertainty over pricing and energy taxes, carbon taxes, that sort of thing, has made money very scarce. But, like, if you look at this TVA plant in Kingston, it's 50 years old. It's one of the 100th most polluting facility in North America. These plants are behemoths. They consume a lot of coal and put out a lot of carbon dioxide. They would be the best targets for us to start reducing our CO2 emissions. It's just unimaginable now that in days like this, with what we know about the climate, that we're still operating these antique plants with this inferior technology that's just killing people locally and threatening people globally with climate change.
So regulation of this stuff being classified as hazardous waste, it's not enough to be asking for, is it?
Well, we need to demand that they do that, just to protect our water and the communities that live near this, absolutely. But we have to stop mining and burning coal because it's a very, very dirty process. And all along the way in this process, there are environmental costs that just totally outweigh any benefit that we get from receiving the cheaper electricity. We have many other ways to make electricity than coal.
Okay, let's talk about where you are now, the Coal River Valley in West Virginia.
Well, this is often called the coal fields by the industry, and it's been a sacrifice area in the Appalachian Mountains. And this has been a coal mining region for over 100 years. Some of these areas have been mining coal for 200 years, but the mountaintop removal process is a relatively recent innovation made possible by the bigger machines that they have.
Big drag lines, right?
There are drag lines, bulldozers, and dump trucks, much larger than anything that most people have ever seen. In the mining of the coal, there is a lot of sorting and cleansing and separating and processing that produces an equal amount of waste as it does when they burn it. And then there's also the overburden that they take off to exposed seams, which is dumped in the stream valleys. Right where I'm standing right now, there are three major mountaintop removal operations. This material is put in these high dams. And the Shumate Dam is almost 400 feet high. That's like half as high as Hoover Dam. Very steep, rugged, knife-edged Appalachian Canyon has a 385-foot high dam. And if this fails, which it certainly will at some point, there's twice as much toxic material behind this as there was in the Tennessee spill. And because of the grade of the river and the towns downstream, would cause much more damage than just spilling out across a floodplain. There's also an elementary school right below the dam, and if it happened during school hours, everyone in that school would be killed.
While coal camps echoed with the mournful sounds of impoverished voices from deep in the ground under this company town, it's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow, until the bottom falls out. That's how it goes down, until the money's all drained from a company town.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Amanda Bellerby. I'm speaking with Earth First co-founder and noted rabble-rouser Mike Rozelle. So, Mike, there's 2.8 billion gallons of coal waste behind this dam.
Yeah.
The community is below this.
The elementary school, Marsh Fork Elementary, is right on the Coal River. And then just below that is the town of Whitesville. So this would continue to fill the canyons and surge down, you know, much like an avalanche would down a canyon, and would result in a much higher loss of life, no matter what time of day it happened at.
Can you share some stories from that community just about what it's like to be that close to mountaintop removal, the blasting and the dust, and just give us an idea what it's like to be near that stuff as it happens?
Well, it's very difficult to be opposed to the coal industry and live in this part of the country. It has been the economic backbone for, you know, almost two centuries. Yet many people here have come to the conclusion that this latest phase of mountaintop removal has just been too much. At 4:20 every day, the blasting happens, and they spend the next 24 hours clearing off the rubble. And exactly why they have chosen that time, I don't know. Some speculation is that the children are out of school at Marsh Fork, and they themselves fear that that would be the most likely time that the dam would fail.
From the sheer force of the explosions, do you mean?
Well, these are not very stable structures, and so shaking them, you can imagine pudding or something. It seems solid, but if you shake it, it will just collapse. There's really nothing holding it back.
So how does it feel when one of these things goes off? Can you feel it in your home?
Well, it rattles the windows all up and down the river. You people here will say, "Damn Massey," when they hear that. there is a lot of resentment over this. Many of the jobs on these types of mine sites are held by people from out of town. There are many locals that do work there. Sometimes this tears families apart. There's a lot of tension over this. People are noticing the lack of hunting and places to get firewood as the mountains are literally being removed. A friend of mine came over today, and a couple of days ago, one of the miners at the MTR site was killed. He'd only been on the job for 6 or 7 days. Massey has refused to compensate him or pay his funeral costs or anything because he hadn't been working there for very long. And we just heard that a coal miner that lives here, a friend of ours, just quit working for Massey over that. So they are used to dealing with coal companies around here, and they've seen some, I suppose, some good ones and some bad ones. But nothing has engendered the animosity and anger that Massey has from the very beginning. Their policy has been to depopulate this area, to extract the coal, and to leave. And it's happening at a scale that is literally just mind-boggling. Where I'm at right now, literally the sun comes up a little earlier every morning because of the fact that Coal River Mountain is being slowly shaved down.
So how is it organizing there with environmentalists coming in from out of town?
The local groups here had reached out to environmental groups across the country, educated people, but the frustrating part, I think, for them is that things still have not changed. And waste instead of fill, so that no more creeks are buried and no more mountaintops are blown up. But, you know, there has been no action taken on that. And even if he was to oppose any new mountaintop removal permits, we're still dealing with the ones that are going on now. So, you know, I think what folks here really want to do is to find any way possible to pressure this administration to immediately end the practice of mountaintop removal and to begin to dismantle all the coal-fired power plants and end coal mining in this area forever. People that I talk to, even though they're rural, even though their families' histories go back many generations, you know, they're concerned about climate change, they're concerned about air pollution, they're concerned about the impacts that coal being mined up here are having all the way down in Knoxville, in the river bottom. And they see the big picture, and they know that something has to be done soon, or their home will be destroyed, but also that their planet will be destroyed. So I feel very honored and privileged to be amongst such really committed, dedicated people. And the feeling here is that they're not going to stop until they succeed. This region has a history of opposition. You know, this is where the union movement was born with United Mine Workers. And they've been through strikes together. And so it's a very strong community. West Virginians, by and large, are in favor of moving away from coal into alternative energy. But in these counties where the coal is mined, the companies have an iron grip on the political process, and they elect the judges, and they have been used to getting their way. And so until that changes, then nothing will be different here. But I think the hope for these groups is that they can somehow arouse the conscience of the nation, and, you know, to bring some additional pressure to bear from outside. When the economy is at stake, generally a majority of the voters, just enough, will keep these people in power. Some of these groups have been around for decades. Judy Bonds, who we work with at Coal River Mountain Watch, was a Goldman Award winner. So these are some very good, talented, staunch organizers, and you know, they spend their time going all over the country. And but if we really want to address climate change, it seems to me that we've got to deal with this coal issue. This is the worst part of coal mining, and it exposes the myth that coal could ever be clean. Scrubbing the carbon out of it doesn't make it clean. Stacking the ash piles up more neatly doesn't make it clean. What makes it dirty is the extraction and processing and trashing of the Appalachian Mountains.
So I guess I need to ask the obligatory, what do you expect from the Obama administration question, because he sure talked about this imaginary thing called clean coal an awful lot on the campaign trail.
Well, I never thought he was serious about clean coal. I think they understand that it cannot be clean, but during his election, he could not afford to lose votes in states that the coal industry is very strong in. But I do believe he said that he was going to pay attention to the science. And he did say that saving the environment is not less important than fixing the economy. So if he sticks to those principles, then you know, certainly he's going to be a vast improvement over the last administration. But I think it's up to us, rather than wait for Obama to do the right thing, is to continue to exert as much pressure now as we ever have, and to make sure that he doesn't do the wrong thing. And the wrong thing would be to put any of this stimulus money into clean coal technology, and instead to focus all of it on ridding us of our addiction to coal, which is rapidly killing us, not slowly killing us.
You've got some actions planned coming up.
We are planning on engaging in civil disobedience a week from tomorrow at the base of the Shoemate Dam. This is something that we don't want Massey to know ahead of time about, because they have a history of mobilizing the women for coal, who can easily outnumber the locals here, and they tend to get very aggressive and violent. And for this particular action, we wanted to preserve some dignity, and we want to maintain the element of surprise. But I expect that that a week from tomorrow there will be a very important demonstration here, where many members of the community come out for the first time and not only oppose the destruction of Coal River Mountain, the Grandfather Mountain, the biggest mountain around here, the mountain from which you can see almost the rest of the state from, but are willing to put their bodies on the line and be arrested to demonstrate that.
What is the most important thing for you going forward from here?
Well, the most important thing for me is that people do not get too taken up in this new presidency. This is not a time to sit back and wait for the government to do those things that need to be done. This is a time for citizens to stand up and demand them. And I'm afraid that if people are too hopeful that we will miss an opportunity, the Obama administration is going to get a lot of pressure from the coal industry and from the people who would like to think that there is such thing as cheap electricity. And it's incumbent for us to really, really redouble our efforts and make this point now, and to take coal off the table. And we have other fossil fuels also to deal with, but certainly this is the worst one. So the thing that really worries me the most is that, you know, I'm old enough to have been around when Jimmy Carter was elected and when Bill Clinton elected, and they promised to do things for us, for the environment, to address these issues, and they did not. They put people on their cabinets and in their administration, and they co-opted the environmental movement by asking them to just step back and allow them to take care of this. So that's my biggest fear. So I have a great deal of respect for the new president. I know he wants to do the right thing, but he is going to need pressure from the environmental movement right now like he's never seen before, and we have to demand clean energy.
And where can people get more information?
Lowbagger.org.
Lowbagger.org, that's your blog. And how about on the mountaintop removal and Coal River Valley?
My favorite place to get information on this issue is the I Love Mountains website, ilovemountains.org.
Great. Well, thanks for all the great information, Mike. We really appreciate you joining us on Flashpoints.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate talking to you.
Our parents memories of World War II. Mines were drowned, the clock was the American thing to do. Families gathered round their radios to hear FDR.
make it somehow in our town. Shafts of morning light on jobless faces and their grim plight, while four men and a drag line blow the mountaintop off to take its heart out. Now it knows what we've lost in this company town. It's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town. Until the life's all drained